Thank you very much. Good morning. Today is Thursday, February 4th, 2021. This is our second of three oral cases for our calendar today. This is case number A20-0920, Brothers Fire Protect. Let me try again. Brothers Fire Protection Company, doing business as Brothers Fire and Security, versus John B. Is it Prismas?
Prismas, yes, Your Honor.
Prismas et al. Each party will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, and counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose. This oral argument is being recorded. However, no other recordings can be done either by video or audio. We will, if there are any issues that come up, we'll certainly accommodate things. We appreciate you joining us virtually through zoom.gov, although we'd certainly like to be seeing each other in person. Obviously, we cannot at this stage, so we appreciate you accommodating us in this way. And with that, I think we're ready to proceed. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 15 minutes. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing, and you may begin.
This is Richard Curott. I represent John Prismas and the other appellants. Essentially, I'm going to be referring to them as Mr. Prismas because he is the entity here. I'm going to briefly talk about what we're talking about. It's a building. It's a mechanics lien case. The building is the high school, or what was the old high school in Mille Lacs. Some of you may have been to Mille Lacs. Mille Lacs is a one stoplight town. This old high school is a big brick building that's on the corner of the one stoplight in the city of Mille Lacs. Mr. Prismas has been working on and off on the building for 20 years. And one of the things that he has to do in the remodeling of the building is put in fire suppression sprinkler systems. And in 2014, he hired Brothers, and I won't refer to the full name of the respondent, I'm just going to refer to them as Brothers. He hired Brothers to put in the sprinkler system. When he hired him in 2014, it was by a written bid contract where they were doing approximately 50,000 square foot of work and at a specific price, a $27,500 price. That contract went fine. And in December of 2017, Mr. Prismas came back to Brothers and said he needed some more sprinkler work done. And an oral agreement was reached. Over an hour, Mr. Prismas spoke with one of the managers for Brothers, and they agreed on an oral contract instead of a written bid contract this time. And they agreed that it would be for time and materials rather than
for just for our clarification, at trial, you raised the issue of time and materials, but for appellate purpose, you're disputing the amount of, you're not disputing the time, you're disputing the reasonable value of the materials.
Essentially, yes, there's a small quibble we have with respect to the times that we've briefed, and I may not even refer to it in my argument. I will if the court wants me to. But yeah, the materials are the primary issue before the court here. And what we're claiming is that the trial court engaged in speculation in finding the damages here.
If I may, counsel?
Yes.
I mean, because we have all read the record and are pretty familiar with this. So the trial court seemed to me there were three witnesses from Brothers that testified and said, yes, the materials were, the cost of those was reasonable. And the trial court credited that, you know, assessing credibility, credited that testimony. Now, I understand what you're saying, that you've been more likely to find someone credible if there have been itemizations, but tell me, what case are you, or statute, and I certainly didn't see it in the statute, relying on to say there has to be itemization? Is that's not clear to me.
Yeah, and that's really the crux of the case, is what do you have to prove? The primary case is the speculation case, the Bonhiever versus Graff case that I cited in my brief. The way Bonhiever states it, and I think it states it fairly well, is that although an award of damages will not be denied merely because of the difficulty of ascertaining them, the amount of damages must be established by the plaintiff and not left to speculation or conjecture. That's the speculation element. However, proof to an absolute certainty is not required. And then it states the following, which I think is the most relevant part. It says that along the line from speculation to certainty, there's a point not found by mathematical demonstration where it can be said that a jury or other fact-finding tribunal can give a safe judgment of the amount of damages flowing from the breach. So that's what we're dealing with, not a statute and not a...
I just have to ask this question, because when I was reading through the file in this matter, I couldn't understand why discovery hadn't ferreted all of that out. I mean, was there not interrogatories or demand for a production of documents saying, give me an itemization? And I'm not saying it's your burden, don't misunderstand me, but in trying to frame this up, I couldn't understand how that didn't happen.
There was a request for production of documents. It's referred to at the beginning of the transcript of the trial, if the court wants to look at it. My request for production of documents was deemed by the trial court tardy, contrary to the scheduling order. And we asked that they be compelled to respond to a request for production of documents that was served.
Right, but you didn't do that until trial. So none of this took place ahead of time.
No, the request for production of documents was made ahead of time. And it was refused by the brothers. Their defense was that it was outside of the discovery period set in the
time. And the scheduling order of the trial court did not remedy all of that situation.
No,
it seems that's why we have rules, is so you have to follow the logical progression so that when you do get to trial, what you're really disputing is fairly obvious.
Right, and we agree that this would have been a much cleaner case if they had at some point presented the evidence of the materials that they had put into the place on it. They chose not to give it to us despite the request. They had a defense. Well,
frankly, I can't help but thinking if I was a trial court judge, I'd say, gee, here's my scheduling order. I withdraw everything I said. I'm the appellate court judge.
And that's a reasonable question. I don't think that the court should fault the brothers for not supplying us with the materials ahead of time, the list ahead of time. We didn't ask for them timely under the judge's scheduling order. So we're stuck with going to trial with not having that information. But it wasn't something we could submit at that point because we didn't have it. And brothers chose not to submit the itemization. So that tells you how it came in or how it didn't come in on it. So the question is, as I see it, is, okay, can they get away with this?
Maybe what I'm trying to say is I'm defending the trial court judge, because to me, it seems a trial court judge did what she could with summaries, and summaries are permitted, but it's the parties that didn't bring this information to the court. Now that's a statement, but what's wrong with the summary? That's a question for you.
That kind of gets into the Thiessen case, the mechanics lien case. Both of us cite Thiessen, which is a mechanics lien case. It's probably the closest case. I guess we're both agreeing it's the closest case in Minnesota case law to our case. And it talks about a situation where a guy who did the work was doing it for time and materials, and his records were a mess. He didn't have good records, but he had records, and he put in itemizations of what it is that he supplied. And some of them were inconsistent. The judge took all of the information that was presented, boiled it into what the judge thought in that case was a reasonable order for the cost of the materials.
Okay, so, counsel, if I may, I'm sorry, Judge Warkey, were you going to add something? If I may, because we have a limited amount of time, turn your attention to the attorney's fees issue. So brothers filed a motion on May 29th, but no hearing date is specified in the motion. Now, this was back last May, right?
Yeah.
And we have an order from the Chief Justice, it's during the pandemic. We have an order from the Chief Justice that, you know, makes it clear what can be considered on paper without hearings, what hearings, if they're held, need to be held remotely. This is a very different time. in the judicial branch. And neither of you, and I want Mr. Cody to answer this as well, at least that I recall, addressed this in your brief. What was the impact of the Chief Justice's order on pandemic scheduling, that, and did it have an impact in this case? So could you address that? And then I do have a follow-up question about just what happened here.
I don't think the Chief Justice's order had any impact at all. They filed the motion. The motion could have been heard remotely.
That's your understanding of the Chief Justice's order, because there were some parts of the order, and I haven't gone back and looked at it with this case in mind, that addressed, you know, when matters could be heard on paper. That order did address some of the rules of general practice.
Right. It didn't change Rule 119, which is the rule that requires that motions for attorney's fees of over $1,000 have to be made.
Right, but that rule, I didn't say, said that brings us back to, was this a non-dispositive motion, right? And then that we have to, that rule would call for a motion, and then you'd have 14 days before the hearing, right?
Right, and the Judge Kulik didn't do anything contrary to the general rule. She didn't claim to be acting under the Supreme Court order. She just issued
the Supreme Court order was never addressed.
It was never addressed. Nothing was addressed because there was no hearing. There was no argument. Judge Kulik received an affidavit in motion and inserted the attorney's fees by issuing a second judgment without a hearing.
You were never told this matter will be, you know, for my consideration by X date. So you need to get your papers in.
No, there was nothing on it.
And the judge entered the order, I guess it was what, 2.5 weeks later? After the
motion. Right, I think it was misstated as far as the number of days in the brief by opposing counsel, but it was approximately 12 days after the affidavit was submitted.
But to be clear, you never opposed it.
There was nothing we filed. We received a motion and had not responded to it yet because there was no motion date on it. We hadn't filed something saying we object to attorney's fees. That's accurate.
Thank you.
Okay. Because the materials part is so important to us, the issue on the speculation, let me be heard. I think I argued it fairly specifically in our brief, but the issue is when the brothers doesn't tell the trial court what it supplied, how many sprinklers, or what type of sprinklers, the court has no basis to find that what was supplied was reasonable. The brothers didn't say whether they supplied 30 sprinklers, 300 sprinklers, or 3,000 sprinklers. We simply don't know. They don't say, and this is important, they don't say whatever number of sprinklers they supply cost them. This is a materials cost contract, and they don't get to put in the materials and say, we can charge a number for it that is unrelated to what they paid for. And they don't tell us what they paid for. They never presented any evidence. What they did was it's five invoices, but it was over $17,000, they said, for materials, the materials being plastic piping and sprinklers.
So, Mr. Curat, whose burden is it? Who has the burden in terms of proving damages?
They do in a mechanics lien case. The claimant has to prove the reasonable value of the materials. The statute says reasonable value. We think in a materials and a contract where it's labor and materials that they have to show the price that they paid for it on it. And the brothers president admitted that a materials contract means that they get to charge the price. There's also overhead that we're not disputing. The court can discretionarily award above that. But the starting point, and you get into pure speculation if you don't have it, is what they paid for it. You know, some days the sprinkler heads may have cost them $2 a sprinkler head. Other times the market might have been $3 a sprinkler head. We don't know what it was that brothers paid for the sprinkler heads.
Okay, so let me ask you this question, Mr. Curat. How do you get around Thiessen's statement that bills and summary listings may be acceptable evidence even without the inclusion of underlying support.
Right, I think they're admissible. That was the primary issue in Thiessen, whether that was admissible. They were challenging the admissibility. And in Thiessen, what they had was ambiguous backup data. But they had the backup data. They had stuff that the court could find was a basis for the number of things. And in fact, the court in Thiessen said that a plumbing fixture that had been returned could not be charged because it was itemized and people could talk about it. Here we can't even talk about it because nothing was itemized on it. And that's the problem here, is that the court can deal with ambiguous data like it did in Thiessen and come to a reasonable conclusion. It can't start from a zero. And we're saying that the court started from a zero here. We do not know anything other than we've got this big brick building where a bunch of sprinkler heads were put into it.
So, counsel?
Yes.
I'd like to take you back to the attorney's fees issue.
Please do.
And I want to be to clearly understand, what are you asking this court to do on that?
I think the only appropriate thing to do would be to remand it to the trial court.
So that you have the opportunity to object.
Object, and if the court rules in our favor on the other issues here today, that will change probably the attorney's fees award. And if it rules against us, we would have the ability still to at least make an argument as to the reasonableness of the attorney's fees claim, one that we weren't able to make, and one which is legitimately there because they did, the judge found that not all of what was billed was appropriate, that to a certain extent, Mr. Prismas was accurate in challenging the attorney's fees that included trip charge, or excuse me, the mechanics lien claim that included trip charges.
Thank you, Mr. Curat. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
We'll now turn to respondent's attorney. You will have 15 minutes. Please state your name for the record and the party you're representing. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name, may it please the court. My name is Michael Cody, C-O-A-T-Y, and I represent Brothers Fire, DBA Brothers Fire Protection Company. They do conduct business under the name Brothers Fire and Security, but I'll refer to them as Brothers Fire. I'd like to highlight, first of all, what we're here for and what we'd like the court to do is affirm the trial court's finding of fact dated May 4th, 2020, awarding Brothers Fire the principal amount of $30,935.65 plus interest, collection costs, and attorney's fees, and affirm the trial court's June 18, 2020 money award in favor of Brothers Fire. And that was in the principal amount of $36,035.55. And that judgment was entered on June 19th, 2020. There are three issues I'd like to highlight for the court this morning. One, whether the trial court had sufficient evidence to determine reasonable value of the labor and materials that Brothers Fire contributed to the improvement of the premises. Two, whether the appellant waived any right it had to object to the interest rate awarded by the court. And three, whether the appellant waived any right it had to object to the attorney's fees awarded by the trial court. I think it's undisputed that the reasonable value is the heart of this issue here. And Minnesota Statute 51303 states that we should recover the reasonable value of the work done, of the skill, material, and machinery furnished. So the question is whether or not the trial court had adequate evidence to support the reasonable value that Brothers Fire claimed. So the appellant seems to indicate that the only thing that the trial court relied on was these billing statements or these invoices, and that's not true. The trial court had a great deal of other evidence which supported its award, including the monthly invoices that set forth the amounts owed for the materials. The invoices set forth the amount of the labor, including the service, the number of hours, and the labor rate.
Well, but Mr. Cody, let me stop you there because I don't think the and you spent a fair amount of time in your briefing on the labor, but I don't think labor is really at issue. I think it's really primarily the materials that are at issue. So I want to focus on that. And there's more detail for labor, but there's no detail for the materials. You have one line saying this invoice is for $10,000 for materials. This invoice is for $2,000 for materials. and obviously I'm rounding the numbers here, but why is that sufficient? And you have the brothers had the burden of production to show that the charges were reasonable. Why is that invoice, why are those invoices by themselves sufficient? It seems to be lacking in detail.
Well, the invoices themselves aren't the only evidence. The issue has not been framed until recently. We didn't know that they were admitting that the labor was acceptable. We thought both were equally objected to. Now we see it's just the material.
The material alone, though, you had plenty of witnesses that kept saying, well, we can get it, we can provide it. That's not what they said, but that's the gist of what they said. So shouldn't we hold that against you that you kept in many ways indicating you'd produce it?
No, well, we didn't say that we would produce it before trial because we didn't know that was the issue. It wasn't framed that way until later on. That's why the court said, we're not going to have discovery now. That ship has sailed. Had we known that was the issue as discovery proceeded, we would have been happy to disclose underlying information. And the reason they didn't ask for it is because Mr. Prisbus was on site day in and day out. He knew exactly what hours were used. He knew exactly what people were on site. He knew exactly what piping, what sprinkler heads and other materials were supplied. That's why he never asked. He got the invoices. They said materials provided. Maybe it wasn't itemized. And he looked at it. He did not object. And he discarded those invoices without asking any questions about them.
Mr. Cody, sorry to interrupt. Why does what he saw matter at this stage when you have damages and you have to prove your damages, you usually have to provide sufficient detail to the district court of what those damages are to satisfy the district court that you are actually entitled to them, whether it's the cost for the materials. And you had testimony from a number of your witnesses, as Judge Warkey pointed out, that said, here we think it's reasonable, but that's a legal conclusion. But they also said we would have submitted detailed information, but to a person, none of them submitted detailed information. So if it was your burden to make sure that you would actually receive the damages that you're requesting, why didn't you produce that information since you have the burden of production?
Again, that issue hadn't been framed until trial. And prior to trial, it was our position that there was an account stated between the parties.
Mr. Cody, is it fair to say nobody asked you?
That's correct, Your Honor. We would have provided them in discovery had it been asked in a timely fashion if the issue would have been framed.
I interrupted your answer to Judge Reyes's question, but you started going on about the account.
Account stated.
Theory, you didn't really argue that in your brief.
Account stated?
But, right.
Well, I think we did in our brief. We said there was an account stated and the court found that there was an account stated between the parties.
Really? Mr. Cody, I'm looking at the district court's order. I thought it was very clear that she was basing this on a contract and on the part between the parties. I didn't see her refer to the account stated.
My recollection was it's in the findings of fact. That's my recollection.
I will go back and look. Can I turn to another area? Because you started out.
May I supplement my answer with one more piece of evidence that I think is crucial? The trial court looked at five witnesses and she could have concluded, these brothers fire witnesses are the kind of people and this is the kind of company that wouldn't send out an invoice unless it reasonably reflected the value of the contribution they made to the improvement of the premises or the project. Similarly,
Mr. Cody, you're saying that we should rely on a credibility determination as to your clients by the court.
Not only my client, but Mr. Prisbus, the court could have found after his testimony that, he's the kind of guy that will dispute no matter the specificity in order to secure an unjustifiable discount on the materials that he provided. The court spent all day listening to these people. I'm sorry?
But Mr. Cody, I'm not sure it's a credibility determination. You can have witnesses credibly testify that, we regularly bill reasonable amounts. We are not in the business of taking advantage of people. And a person can testify credibly to that, but the underlying invoice may indicate a mistake. For example, invoices that may have been billed to the wrong party. I don't think it's an issue of credibility and whether or not how Brothers does business. I think I see it as an issue of whether or not there are sufficient facts in the record to support the district court's findings of fact. And if there are not, then those findings of fact are clearly erroneous. And I'm struggling with the lack of details. You produce the invoices, the general invoices, but that's just a summary. That's you know, where's that underlying detail to support those?
Well, in my opinion, with the accounts dated and with the testimony that and the invoices that were submitted, that is sufficient along with the account stated.
Mr. Cody, may I now move to another area and ask my question?
Yes, please.
Thank you. I'd like to go to your waiver. We think of this probably in terms of forfeiture argument. So I must say, with regard to the interest and attorney's fees, you file your motion, and I understand that, you know, just speaking for myself, not for the panel, district courts do not always have to have hearings on every motion, but how would appellant have known when to file their objections if there was neither a motion nor, you know, something from the court that says, I'm considering this as of this date? Because I would look at this and say, well, usually under the rules, you know, it's non-dispositive motions, you file things 14 days before. Maybe there's some other time period you would like to point me to, but that concerns me. So if you want to address that, and in so doing, tell me. So if the district court got your motion on the 29th and issued an order, the same order 3 days later, would you be saying the same thing?
No, I wouldn't. I liken this almost like a default judgment. The trial court can decide whether or not it wants to have a hearing if a defendant is in default. As far as I was concerned, this particular issue, the defendant was in default because he did not respond.
So if I may, when did the defendant become in default? So what time period, looking at the rules of civil procedure in the district court general practice rules, would you say, okay, this is when it ran, he was in default?
Well, I think that's in the discretion of the trial court. If the trial court waited 20 days and didn't hear anything, I think they have the authority to decide not to put it on their schedule.
Do you
on
have,
their calendar.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Do you have any thoughts on the effect of the Chief Justice order on whether a motion should or could be held during these time periods, kind of along the lines of the questions I asked counsel for appellant?
I really don't, Your Honor. My position was I put it in the court's hand to schedule it if they so thought it was needed. I suspect that when there was no opposing pleadings filed, the court decided a hearing was not necessary and signed the order.
Can we go back? Because maybe you said this and it just wasn't clear to me. And when did you think there was a default? What period of days can you trace that to?
Well, I would say that's within the discretion of the court. My understanding was the court waited 20 days before signing the order. And I thought that was sufficient. But I think if the court decided 10 days, I mean, it's up to the court.
Would you agree that there is not a factual basis in the record other than your motion to support the interest that the district court ordered, the amount of it?
I would submit that as far back as the complaint, the plaintiff asked for 1.5% per month in interest. That was not objected to. And there's a series, I can go through the other pleadings that it said, we are seeking 1.5%, 18% per month. I thought that dispute was resolved because it wasn't objected to.
So was it in the pleadings, but not at trial? Is that fair to say?
Right, because I thought the issue was resolved. Now, had that been brought up in trial, I would have presented more evidence about the terms and conditions of this contract, which were on the backside of the bidding document that said 1.5% per month. I thought that issue was resolved.
But I thought it was an oral agreement that we had here.
I disagree with that characterization. I think it's a written contract reflected in the bid documents and the invoices and the terms and conditions. Only the time and materials number wasn't, they weren't able to determine that until the time and materials were contributed to the improvement of the project. So that's the only term I would say that was part of an oral agreement. It's a written contract.
But even under statute, if there's no written agreement, then under statute, it has to be set at 6%. And even if there is a written agreement, it's considered, I can never pronounce the word correctly.
Usurious.
Thank you. If it's over 8%.
But this is a written contract. They're a business contract. They're entitled to have interest at 1.5%. per month or 18% if both parties agree, and they did in this case.
But that seems to be an issue for the district court to determine whether or not anything over 8%, first of all, whether or not there is a written agreement, and second of all, if there is a written agreement, whether anything over 8% is permissible. And so that seems to be an issue for the district court. But actually, I want to go back to Judge.
May I respond? 1.5% interest in business deals, including subcontractors. I've been representing them for more than 30 years. Most of them have that provision in the terms and conditions of their subcontracts.
I certainly understand that, but that seems to be an issue for the district court, not for us, in terms of determining whether or not that is really.
I would respond by saying that issue has been waived because it was never brought up.
I want to go back to the issue of the attorney fees. The district court, why isn't it that the district court, why shouldn't we conclude that district court abused its discretion because it never even considered the 9 factors that it must consider before making its award?
Well, first of all, I'd put on the record that no one's ever objected to the amount or the rate or the amount that we sought in attorney's fees, even to this day. So I think it was well within the trial court's discretion to approve them.
But I think that goes back to Judge Justin's point of when did they have the opportunity, if no hearing date was even set, to more or less start that clock running of putting the other side on notice.
Well, I think at some point when there's a motion pending, you don't wait for a hearing date to oppose it, whether or not there's a rule specifically stating so.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Any other questions from Judge Justin and Judge Borky? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Cody.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Curat, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Any suggestion that this wasn't an oral contract completely misstates the record and what the parties have argued in this. This was an oral contract. There was a reference to a statement that was drawn up by Mr. Odenkrantz, the manager, on the 17th or 18th of December. It was an internal document. The testimony says it was an internal document. It's never given to my client. This was an oral contract case, not a written contract case on it. The speculation part of it is that the materials here could have been 60 sprinkler heads, 600 sprinkler heads, or 6,000 sprinkler heads. The cost of the sprinkler heads to Brothers could have been $2 a head, $5 a head, $50 a head. We don't know. And that's why the court was it exceeded its discretion as a fact finder in making this a call reasonable. It's our opinion or our argument, I guess, that this isn't a matter of opinion as to value until there is some predicate information as to how much was provided and what the quality of what was provided. You had a question.
I want to stop you right there, if I may. And yeah. I want to go back to the Thiessen case, because in that one, not only did the Supreme Court say that bills and summary listings are acceptable, but they actually referred to and acknowledged that bills and summaries are acceptable if you have somebody who can verify that they knew that the items and labor the materials were furnished for the project as specified in the invoices. And here, respondents rely in particular on Mr. Odenkrantz, who was the project manager for this, who oversaw it among other people. And Mr. Odekrans specifically said, yeah, the costs that we incurred were reasonable. And so why it's that seems to be sufficient under Thiessen.
Under Thiessen, the question was the admissibility of the billings, of the poorly put together billings and ambiguous billings. And the court found that those records were admissible and that even though they were ambiguous, there was therefore enough evidence for the court to make its decision. It wasn't an argument in Thiessen that there was no evidence of what was provided. And in fact, in Thiessen, it refers a couple points. It's as to the itemizations that were presented in that case. So Thiessen wasn't a case where there was not an itemization. It was an itemization that was at different points ambiguous and didn't always agree with the billings on it. Here we have simply no itemization, and that's the failure from our perspective. And the difference from Thiessen, from our perspective. We cited in our case on this general issue as to the speculativeness, the Drelin versus Karen case. It goes back to 1934, but was the best I could find. And what it talked about was that there was a claim for value of services where a guy said he should be awarded a certain number of dollars for the hours for the work that he did, but he didn't say how many hours he worked or what his hourly rate was. And we think that that is the analogy here. The court says it's pure speculation if you don't know the number of hours or the hourly rate to say that $500 is a fair number for labor. And the analogy we're claiming here is here we have billings. If you add them up, it's over $17,000.
What do we do about the testimony of the brothers? I think it was the president that does, he does this. I mean, when you don't have a scope, that's the scope of the project isn't defined. And his testimony was that he does it thousands of time and materials projects when the scope isn't defined. And the district court recognized that. So was the district court wrong in recognizing that?
No, and in fact, that's the appropriate thing in materials contract case is when there isn't a definition beforehand, it's to set the definition after the work is done. But the definition of what, or the materials provided after the materials are provided. But the definition isn't based upon speculation, upon not knowing what was provided. The burden is for the plaintiff or the claimant to put in what was provided and to, frankly, in this type of materials case, to say, we bought this stuff for this many dollars from our suppliers. And if they said, we got this from our suppliers for 5,000 bucks and we want to charge you 6,000 bucks because of a markup, the court would have had something to go on. Here, we do not have what he paid his suppliers for this stuff. And we don't have what the amount of the stuff. And that's why we argue in our brief that we don't know if there's 3,300 or 3,000 sprinkler heads.
Judge Reyes, if I may, may I ask one additional question?
Yes.
Counsel, I asked you at the end of your first argument what you were asking this court to do on the attorney's fees issue. Let me ask the same on the interest rate issue. Are you asking this court to set an interest rate or are you asking us to send it back to the district court along with the attorney's fees for that to be played out at the district court?
It's a pure legal issue because this is an oral contract. The court should, from our perspective, set the interest rate at 6%.
And I'm going to ask one more question because I'm presiding and I can do that. I want to follow up on that one to your quest. Isn't this, aren't there factual underpinnings to the issue of interest?
I don't know what you mean by actual underpinnings. Could you tell me what you're looking for?
Sure. So what I mean is, isn't there an issue of whether or not there actually is a written contract that does control here? So what are the terms of it?
I don't think so. I think the court found that there was an oral contract and that hasn't been challenged by either of the parties on it, that there was an oral agreement. If I'm wrong, then perhaps it should be remanded on it. But my understanding is that there was not an issue about an oral contract, and counsel's suggestion that there's a written contract here falsely deals with the record.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you both for your oral arguments. Very well argued, we appreciate that, and very well briefed as well. So we will be issuing an order within the statutory timeframe, which